everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Dark Fusion Podcast. I am Shane Douglas Keene, and I am joined, as usual, by Beverly Lee and Stephanie Ellis. And tonight, we are talking to Mother Horror herself, Sadie Hartman. Sadie, it is so awesome to have you here. The last time I talked to you on a podcast was on Ink Heist, and you were a guest host on that one.
Oh, yeah.
This is the very first time I've had you on as a guest, and why that is, I have no idea other than negligence. thank you for being here. It's a bucket list item, and I'm sure we're going to have a great conversation.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for asking me.
So pretend like there's a soul in the horror industry that does not know who Mother Horror is, and tell them a little bit about Sadie Hartman.
Okay, well, so my name is Sadie Hartman, and I am a childhood book nerd grown up into an adult book nerd, and nothing else has really changed other than the fact that the internet came along and I was able to join a little community of book nerds called Bookstagram, where I was fortunate enough to meet some really cool people like Beverly Lee.
I know. 2015, I checked back. My God.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, you've been like my oldest friend there. And it was just so cool to meet other women, especially, who enjoyed the darker side of fiction. I would post, you know, my excitement for some new Stephen King or an Anne Rice or something. And it was just so cool to find other women who were just as excited as I was, because I didn't have any real life friends that I could gush with besides my mom. And then I kind of carried my act over to book Twitter, and found a whole new group of people, and primarily all the authors of the books I was reading. Bookstagram tends to be more of the readers, and Twitter tends to be a lot of the writers as well. So started, you know, doing my song and dance over there about horror, and met a whole new community of people and just had so much fun talking about horror and telling authors how much I enjoy their work and how much their stories mean to me. And then eventually I just started getting some review gigs at, you know, Scream Magazine and Cemetery Dance and various different platforms. And then I opened Nightworms with my best friend Ashley, and that's been going for, it'll be our third year. We'll be celebrating our third year in October. So that's me.
it's amazing how Nightworms has grown, isn't it? Has it exceeded your expectations?
Yeah, 100%. We capped the orders. Our very first pre-order, we capped at 100 because we were certain that we would never sell over 100. And sure enough, within like a few days or whatever, we had capped our order and could have gone more, but we just were scared and didn't know like what kind of work we were getting ourselves into. And now it's just, you know, 10 times that amount. So
yeah, gonna say now you show pictures with pallets of boxes stacked in.
Yeah, I have like truck driver friends who come here on freight trucks and dump off a pallet of books that, you know, I unpack as the warehouse manager myself. So
it brought
wheeling and dealing in horror.
It brought memories back to me when the last time you posted a picture like that, because I worked in a book distribution warehouse, you know, a very small one down in Roseburg, and we constantly had this big bay full of pallets, full of boxes, just like that. And it's like, oh no, it's a nightmare coming back.
For sure. I mean, it's interesting because with the supply chain shortage happening right now, it's like we don't really know the future of the printed word for the next foreseeable year or two. So Ashley and I have been having conversations about what that's going to look like for a monthly subscription service, where we're planning packages months in advance. So it's just, at some point, it's the same with COVID in 2020. We didn't know when the wheels were going to stop turning. So
yeah,
it's kind of what we're facing now.
Yeah, the whole world is a play it by ear sort of a scenario anymore.
Yep.
Fortunately, I mean, it's weird to say, but fortunately for all four of us in this crew, we're all 40 plus. And we've been through a thing or two, and it's a lot easier to adapt. We're accustomed to things coming along and changing the world on us. You know, we all grew up and grew through the internet age, and, you know, just we've seen so many changes and seen so many bad things happen over the years that it's better for us. I feel bad because I know a lot of young people who are really, really close friends, and they've really, really struggled with things not just being the way they've always expected them to be, you know. And it's really, really hard collectively on the mental health of all of us, but especially I've noticed younger people seem to get a lot more stressed about it. And for good reason, like you said, we don't have any fucking clue what's coming around the next corner, you know. So
I think in the UK, if you survived the 70s, which were quite bad over here, we had power cuts and shortages and all sorts at the time. Yeah, dead bodies piling up, wasn't it, because they weren't being buried.
Yeah,
I think that is making this feel it's easier to control. So I tell my kids some of the things that happened in the 70s and they just roll their eyes, but I'm hoping that it shows them that you can get through things, hopefully with a bit of a laugh along the way as well, whether that's trying to read by candlelight and setting your hair on fire when you're doing it. But
I was too young to really remember, except that we went through a major gas crunch, and all I can really remember, because I was so young and my memory sucks so bad, is pushing our car in a line up to a gas station that we were 3 miles away from because we were out of gas. So every time the line would move a car length, we'd have to jump out and push the car again.
Yeah, we've got our petrol stations. A lot of them are closed at the minute, especially around here. And it's just because people have been panic buying, not because there's a shortage. They've gone out and they've caused the issue. And that's media driven as well. I think the media now has a lot to answer for these days. I think they're the ones who panic people rather than the actual situation.
Absolutely. And intentionally.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases, you know, media thrives on this situation. You know, they're, because everybody glues themselves. It's not a matter of enjoying watching. It's a matter of, you know, in some cases in America, there are people who, oh, my God, it's another scandal. You know, Sadie knows about those. She's always at the heart of those things.
Oh, God. I do think there is like a silver lining if, you know, that have some silver linings that have emerged. Like, I saw one Twitter user tweet the other day, it could have been yesterday even, but she was saying that she doesn't really like when people say they wish that things could return to normal, because normal for her meant that she was excluded from going to cons and things because it was unaffordable. And so during COVID, there were so many writing events and book events and cons and things that were virtual, which meant she could go to them all. And I think that that's really important, that we've learned that we don't need to rely on these physical present, you know, meetings. Because traveling is so expensive. It's so, so very expensive. And it was so cool to go to StokerCon and get to chat with Aaron Dries, who's in Australia. Like, when would this ever happen? You know, I doubt Aaron and I will ever be at the same con, you know? So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I agree. That was because I'm one of those people that, you know, cons are a thing that you hope to go to someday. But aren't really in the budget. And so, yeah, COVID was in that way for me. Yeah, I agree with her, her or him, whoever it was, that it in that way, I don't think we should go back. I think we should keep having events like that. Not all of them, obviously, because we need physical contact with people. But it not just includes more people, which is good for those people. It includes more people, which is good for the authors involved in the events, because it gives you another, you know, one more venue to spread your name and your message around. So, yeah, I agree with you. We should kind of not look at going back so much as going forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, talking of going forward, Sadie, you started writing now and your short stories are coming out into the world. How do you feel being on that side of the fence as a writer, rather, you know, waiting for somebody to review your work as opposed to you reviewing somebody else's?
So, oh my gosh, I will tell you that this is going to be super honest. I hate it.
I
hate writing fiction, and I hate feeling like I'm putting it out there. And like almost every time I've ever submitted something, I've always told the person on the receiving end, like, give it back. I changed my mind. This is not going out there. I hate it. And they've always had to try to convince me, like, no, it's fine. They get these panicky emails. No, I'm taking it back. I don't want to be in it. I don't want to do it. Which is primarily why I always just do charity anthologies, because I feel like nobody is spending any money on me. It's actually going to charity because I don't want them to be like, well, that was a waste. That was just a piece of shit. So I would never, ever want to write like what you guys do. Like, I just, it's just too much. It's too, like, I can't. That's the honest truth.
But we're just so masochistic writers, aren't we? We sort of create and nurture this thing, and it can take anything from a year to, you know, 3 years to put something out. And then we just throw it out there for people to pick to pieces.
Oh, yeah. I think that it's really given me like so much insight on how to do a review, and just to you know, be so sensitive and just overly generous with praise first and then just critical later, and just the criticism should just come from a place of like respect and kindness, and never from a place of like being flippant about what you're saying, or, you know, not intentional or not thought through, or just, you know, like careless with your words. Like, I just, someone's art is just so personal, so deeply personal to them, that I really try hard to never like take that lightly, you know, and just be blasé about it.
I do too. I especially more so now, because I'm more sensitive to what people might say about me, and it makes me realize how a person could get hurt. But I'm not with movies. With movies, I'm intentionally vicious. If I hate a movie, my reviews are. And it's not to be mean. It's because people think they're fun. People think it's fun when I find 100 different metaphors for why, you know, particular films suck. But so, yeah, that's my favorite pastime, is looking for really bad movies and then destroying them. But yeah, otherwise, I lost my train of thought entirely.
I'm not very good at watching horror movies. I'm a bit like
yes. Me too.
Yeah, they're not my thing. Well, I watch them, but not many. I've noticed you comment on that on Twitter a few times about horror movies not really being your thing. And it's sort of sacrilege almost in the community, isn't it? Because it's, how did you get to horror? What was the first horror films you watched? And that wasn't really part of my life as such. Yes, you watch horror, but it wasn't the thing. I don't know, what was the earliest horror film that you watched? I mean,
Yeah, it's just my daughter makes fun of me because my daughter and my son, the older two, like love horror and watch a lot of it. And they kind of scream things for my husband and I because we're big babies. So they'll be like, no, mom and dad, this one's not for you. It's too scary. You know, you won't like it. But there's a huge difference between visual horror and written horror. I mean, it's just, it's huge. You know, written horror is just between, it's transactional between you and the author. Like, they give you the words, you get to conjure the visual in your brain, and it stays there, and it doesn't go any further. Whereas there's a whole team of people creating visual effects, and you're watching it with, you know, generally people are watching a movie with other people. So it's like, you know, it's this community vibe where it's just all the stuff kind of crammed into your brain without your consensus, without your permission, without your, you know, nothing you would invent for yourself. It's also a surprise. And so it's just, it's really like too much for me most of the time. And the first movie that I ever saw was a complete mistake. Like, I was spending the night at a friend's house and her parents put on The Exorcist, and you just jump right into the deep end of the pool. You know? That was like, oh God, no, I just can't. I will never watch another movie like that, you know.
Traumatized.
I'm of the opinion that that's the scariest movie ever made, in my opinion, but I don't know why. I'm not religious, but that movie scares the fuck out of me.
It's terrifying. It made me not want to read the book. I only read the book like a few years ago because I just was so traumatized by the whole thing.
I can't imagine. I watch a lot of horror, but I'm very selective anymore. It's kind of like if it's real, real super gory and violent, I just don't see the sense in it. Most of the time I sit there and count the shocks. And then go, okay, now if I took all of that out of there, would there be a story here? Would there be just a little short film? Mm-hmm. You know, because at that point in time, then I'd rather just go watch one of Izzy Lee's films and, you know, call it a good day. So.
Yeah, I hear that.
What are you reading, Sade?
Well, I just finished Beverly Lee's book, The House of Little Bones. I'm a huge fan of Bev's, and not just because we've been friends for such a long time, but because she's truly a gifted writer. She penned probably my favorite vampire novels out of all the vampire novels. She wrote the Gabriel Davenport series or trilogy, so I highly recommend that. And The House of Little Bones was wonderful. So I just finished that, and I moved on to the Chasing the Boogeyman by Richard Chizmar. It's so good. It's so good. If you love true crime, you absolutely need this book because it reads like a true crime podcast.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. And Richard is a hell of a writer, too.
Yeah, and it has, you know, if you like coming of age, it has coming of age elements to it. He really goes into the small town aspect. And then, yeah, there's a series of murders that he's kind of investigating. He wrote himself into the book. So it's Richard Chizmar, starring Richard Chizmar.
his mentor was kind of an unknown, but, you know, did give him a lot of pointers on the way too. I envy his relationship with Stephen King quite a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're going to have a mentor, be it Stephen King.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Stephen King follows you on Twitter now, Sadie.
Yeah, I try not to think about it, honestly.
So everything you say, Stephen King reads.
Yeah, I'm hoping that he, like, mutes me or something. Because it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, that's a good thing to just imagine he mutes you. He followed you out of a sense of propriety and then muted you right away.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I actually did put it as my pinned tweet just a few days ago, just to remind myself, you know, because I think that sometimes we're our own worst enemy. And I was just going through feeling like, I don't know, I was just kind of hit a low place in my self-esteem where I was like, I don't feel like I'm relevant. I don't feel valued. I don't feel important. Just a slew of different feelings that made me really question my commitment to the community, because the community can be hard sometimes. And I just was like, no, I need to kind of remind myself and get back to what I do and why I do it. And so I just kind of pinned that tweet for a while just to be like, your hero, your fucking hero of all time, like, sees you as a person. And it's not like he follows like 5,000 people. He follows like under 200 people. So I don't know. It just kind of reminds me that like, I'm not here for accolades or, you know, community support and stuff. I'm here for the celebration of horror and why I got into it in the first place.
But we have to celebrate our own achievements though as well, don't we? I think, as you say, by reminding yourself that he is following you. I mean, I don't know whether it's a gender thing, but I think women are not very good at sort of saying that they're good at something.
Yeah.
Because we get shit back on it.
I was just going to say, if you want to talk about women in horror and a poster child for triggered men, no offense, Sadie, but I'm looking at you. When Sadie was starting out and seeing this amazing overnight success, a lot of the boys got very, very, very uptight about that. I had some conversations that lost me friends with a lot of guys. Sadie lost a lot more, not friends, just assholes. But I mean, it was just another one of those aspects, like you say, of all the shit you deal with when you start coming up and looking like you're gonna get something they don't have, you know. Just, and it has to be your gender. It couldn't possibly be that you're good at it, you know, right. Which seems. You know, and it's like, you know what? That's something I wanted to talk to you about, too. And we can go into greater. It's jealousy. Professional jealousy in this community, especially amongst men and women, is just ridiculous because there's room for everybody. And if you're a man, there's twice as much room for you, you know. So don't get jealous. Just say fucking congratulations, my hero, you know.
Well, I mean, I'm. So Cemetery Dance purposefully was looking for female voices, which is why they invited me to the table, because they were just tired of hearing from men on the topic of horror.
Yep.
hold on. Excuse me one sec. Sorry, I just like choked on my own spit.
I've been there.
Okay. So also Scream did the same thing. And it's funny that they were doing it at the same time. Mm-hmm. I think they just saw like a real need for a woman's perspective on horror. And I, you know, was over the moon to fill that role. Like, you know, there wasn't any kind of like insidious purpose, or, you know, I didn't have any ill intentions to walk into a scene and kind of take over. That's nobody's intention when they start growing in success and seeing, you know, traction on social media. No one is actually intending to come in and steal a limelight or, you know, suck all the air out of the room. That was never my intention. And if people see it as that, or, you know, I say something offensive or something they don't agree with, or they have some sort of like issue, like my door is always open. I'm a very personable person. I'm, you know, easy to talk to. Like, I just don't understand why people always take it to social media when they can just do it privately.
I don't either. That's something you and I have done very well over the years. We've had our differences over the years, but it's one of the things that makes you such a good friend of mine is that I know that anytime something is bothering me about a situation between us or anything at all, I can message you and say, what's up with this? And you're going to talk to me. You're not just going to say, oh, fuck you, dude, take it to the airwaves or whatever, you know? And that's important, I think, in this community, because there are going to be controversies. There are going to be differences of opinions. But I can tell anybody in this community listening that if you do have an issue with Sadie Hartman, if you just message her and say, I have an issue with you, she's going to say, let's talk about it. No guarantee you'll work it out. But all the shade and all the game playing tends to be on the other side of the fence. But I recommend that approach with everybody. If somebody pisses you off, contact them and say, hey, you pissed me off. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But
yeah. I think one of the worst things on Twitter is the sort of subtweeting when people are being vague, but not quite vague enough, and they stir and they stir. And then quite often they'll say they're offended by something and people should just not say anything, but then they're mixing it up themselves, and it's just never ending. It's almost like
it's really
attention
destructive.
Attention seeking from adults in a way, and they should just leave it just get back to books and things.
That's one point I was going to make when Shane was talking was you know, if I always think there's something other going on. There's some other agenda going on. If somebody would rather subtweet or out somebody for some offense that they did towards them or against them, but haven't really taken it to the person specifically first, like, we have not learned that in society. We have learned in our businesses, in our family practices, and like our relationships, like, if you have a problem, like, it's really best just served. Like, you don't just walk outside of your house to a room full of complete strangers and go, this issue, you know, blah, 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 and then get people to, like, rally around you and around this issue while the person you're talking about is like, is this about me? Like, what the fuck is happening? You know, what did I do? Like, I'm not really sure. And then there's this danger of, like, if you think it's about you and you want to, like, talk to them, there's this fear that, like, if you go to them and you say, like, is this about me? Did you talk about me? Then they're going to screenshot it and put that out there too, you know, like, as like, you're bullying me or you're harassing me or whatever. So I don't know. I really just don't think that we have learned the ropes of social media at all. I think we're all just fuddling through, and screwing things up as we go and destroying communities and destroying people. And, you know, when really I just think, like, going straight to the person and just, you know, pulling up your big person pants and being like, here's this thing I need to say that's really hard, and not avoid conflict, because I feel like conflict is healthy. You know, it's how things get resolved. Otherwise, it just blows it up and involves a bunch of people that don't need to be involved.
And really, it builds relationships. I mean, because you build it, so you build a mutual respect when you go to the source and actually confront them, you know. Or you should. If you don't, then they're not really your friend anyway. But yeah, I agree with you entirely.
Yeah, or just block the person if it's really that bad and you don't want to deal with them. You don't have to tell everyone you did it.
And if it's a matter of professional courtesy, something that I use frequently, you don't want to appear to have blocked this person and be in controversy with them. That's all well and good, but for your own peace of mind, just fucking mute their name, you know? Mute them and mute their name, you know? And problem solved, you know? Nobody's anything for the worse, and your stress is a little bit lower. But that's kind of a good place to segue into something that you talk about in one fashion or another over periods of time, or rather have over the time I've known you, and that is what I jokingly called the power of positive reading a while back. And I mean, because I got some shade a few years back, and you did too, about why do you only write positive reviews? Why are there no, you know, one stars? Or I mean, especially in my case, because I think I've written two reviews that were less than 4 stars in my entire reviewing, you know, as far as book reviews go. But there's a philosophy behind that, and you've talked about it some, and I like to hear your points of view about that, and I'd like everybody else to as well.
Okay, yeah, sure. So I do actually write 1, 2, and 3 star reviews. I just don't advertise it. I don't, like, you know, put it out there. Yeah. On social media. I don't put it on Instagram. I don't put it on Twitter. They're there on Goodreads if anybody wants to, like, look them up, or if they, you know, like, read a book and then they see, oh, she actually didn't like this, you know, and I have, like, a really, you know, I'll put in there why it didn't agree with me. But I don't feel like my purpose as a reviewer is to dissuade anybody from picking anything up, because people's preferences are wildly different. So I don't say in my reviews, like, definitely skip this one, or I wouldn't read this, or don't waste your money. Like, I would never say that, because I feel like a book has its audience no matter what. And then my editor at Scream likes when I have 1 to 3 star reviews. He doesn't want just all 5 stars.
Yeah,
and I write 4 reviews, you know, for every magazine. So there has to be, like, a variety. And I just really try to be respectful. And so most of the authors have told me that, like, oh, thanks for reviewing my book. I know that it wasn't your cup of tea, because I've given it, like, 1 or 2 stars. But they've seen an uptick in sales, because I try to, you know, push the selling points that I think a Scream magazine fan would appreciate. Like, you know, it's a slasher, or it was too gory for me. All those buzzwords that are going to make somebody pick it up. So I honestly just think people read reviews because they want to see what to read, not what not to read.
Well, yeah. And that was where that joke about the power of positive reading came in, is that really more on the reader's side of things. You're not looking for a book you hate. You're not looking for a book to write a bad review about. You're looking to enjoy something, you know?
Sure, totally.
Because a lot of people seem to think that 3-star reviews are bad. And for me, a 3-star review is rubbish. You know, it's good. Well, when I say it's rubbish, I mean, a 3-star is good. It's rubbish thinking that it's a bad, you know, it's a good story. It's entertaining. Yeah. That's what a 3-star to me means. I just wish, in a way, we could get away from this whole star business and then just focus on the words that people say about the book.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
And that totally would be, agree. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's easy as a writer, especially as a new writer, to get very hung up on the star rating. And if somebody does give your book a 3-star, to then get very down about it because you think that it's no good. I mean, writers have got to have really thick skins, but new writers, you know, it's very difficult. I remember back when I was a new writer and I got my first 3-star, I was like, oh my God, that's it. I'll never write anything again.
Aww.
But yeah, the star rating is antiquated. It really needs to change.
It does. I don't really find that there's any purpose in it. I don't give stars with my Cemetery Dance reviews, and yet I feel like it's very clear how I felt about it. I mean, there will be more criticism, you know, on something that I didn't enjoy particularly, and then just lots of glowing praise on the ones that I did. So, and you know, the spectrum varies, and it doesn't matter. People are gonna just read the words and pull from it what they found to be interesting, you know?
Yeah. Oh, there's our awkward silence.
I'm gonna jump in with a question for Sadie. I'm always amazed by how much you accomplish, Sadie, and your time management skills. Do you have to be very firm with yourself?
Yes. I do have to be very firm with myself. I wake up at 4 a.m. People are always like, why do you do that? How do you do that? Why you should stop doing that. But I go to bed super early. I go to bed at like, I'll peel off from the family around 8 o'clock at night and read for an hour, hour and a half in bed, and then wake up at 4 in the morning. Because I feel like that's when my brain is the freshest, is right when I wake up. So I write the most reviews and do the most things, you know, between 4 and 9. And then the rest of the day, I can kind of like squeeze in the stuff that comes up, because if you've answered a ton of emails and responded to a bunch of people at 4 in the morning, there, it's all coming back in, the responses throughout the day. So I'm managing all of that for multiple businesses. So my own reviews, my own business Nightworms and all that that entails, the publicity for Stygian Sky Media and Death's Head Press, a newsletter for Cemetery Dance Germany that I have to have done at the end of every month. And I just compile information for that all throughout the month. And then I also have my reviews, various articles for Lit Reactor and Tor Nightfire. And I have to write this all down and make sure that I'm meeting all the deadlines. And that's why one of the things that I tell authors when I accept a review copy for consideration or I buy a book is, this will probably not make my priority list super quickly, because it's just, I have to be able to read and write and do all the things that I do, you know, in one day, every day on repeat. So I write down deadlines of book releases and things, but like I very rarely make them. I feel bad about sometimes, but
I'm exhausted just hearing all that. And in between that, you've got to like, you've got to cook and sort of actually go outside for fresh air, maybe fit in a little bit of sort of tidying the house up.
Well, so one thing I did make a priority for in the last like 3 months that I haven't before is self-care and exercise. So yeah. I leave my desk somewhere around 10 or 11 and I go for this hour and a half long walk along the water in my town or my city. And I get to see seals and boats coming in and out and smell clean air and, you know, really just escape like a lot of the chaos that kind of surrounds my day. It's so important. I would never forsake it after I've started doing it every day.
Yeah, it's very easy for us just to sort of stay perched in front of the screen for hours and hours on end, and really it does you no good in the long run, because you're not rested enough to produce anything decent.
Yes, that's so true.
You're so immersed in horror in the books and the writing and everything else. Is there anything else that you read to take you away from that, just to give yourself a break and maybe a different perspective or a breath of fresh air, but in reading terms, is there something else that you read?
Yeah, I do read, so right now I'm reading the Happen Leonard series by Joe Lansdale, which is hilarious. Like I need those laughing moments, you know? And he strikes me so funny. His, just the way that Joe Lansdale frames his characters and uses dialogue to really vehicle a story is so refreshing. Like the dynamic between Hap and Leonard is like my favorite thing right now. Like, and I really, really needed it. I do need a break from the darkness sometimes, because I'll even venture into like, you know, murdery books and dark mysteries, and it's like everything is dark, even if I venture off into fantasy or thrillers or whatever, it's still grisly. So the Happen Leonard series is really fun.
Yeah, Shane's on mute, I think.
Either he's on, oh yeah, you're on mute, Shane.
I am. I do that because I have noise behind me, but I like everything else, I never remember to turn it back on. I'm always sitting here when we weren't using video before and nobody would notice my lips moving on Ank Heist. I'm just sitting there talking away and some people will be talking over me. I'm what the fuck, you guys? You know? And then you, oh,
nothing. Oh, whoops.
So I believe your mum is a horror reader, isn't she, Sadie?
Yes, my mom is a big fan of horror. And it's really cool, you guys, because my dad never read, ever. Like, we would buy him books and stuff for his birthday and different things, and he would never read them, primarily because the man is self-employed. He has a landscaping business, and he was exhausted by the time he came home to his three daughters. But now he is a huge reader, and he's going through all of Stephen King's books. He read the Dark Tower series. He's picking out books himself and, like, fanboying over various different authors that he really enjoys. Like, he loves Elmore Leonard and Joe Lansdale. And he's just – it's so cool that both my parents are, like, obsessed with reading now. And we get to talk about books, and they love the Nightworms, and they read my reviews and buy indie horror, which they were not doing before. So it's really exciting.
And it's always very easy for Christmas presents, because you know what to buy them now.
Oh, yeah. I send them Nightworms packages as presents, and they like love that. And they love hearing about all of your guys' lives. Like, you know, I don't know, if I'm following you on social media and you're an author that I read a ton of and we talk in our DMs, you are my friend. Like, if I'm talking to my mom, I'll be like, oh, my friend Beverly, or my friend Stephanie, or my friend Shane, you know, and it's like, yeah, it's like I have all these friends, and my parents are just like, oh, can you get this signed book for me? Or can you, you know, do this or that? And it's just, it's really cool. I enjoy that part of my life.
I do too. I enjoy that. I don't have that with my family, but I agree. I enjoy the part of my life where I can do things like say to a bunch of people, hey, do you want to review so-and-so's book? I can get you signed copies of this or whatever, you know, like when we did the Betty thing, you know, it's like I get to do stuff like that all the time. And I love that about my life. You know, I love taking these authors that I've fallen in love with and championing them and spreading that love, you know. So,
oh my gosh, Shane, I'm like forever in your debt for Betty. Oh god.
Are you sure you don't want to kill me for that?
No, I so thankful that you turned me on to that book. Like, what an amazing book.
Yeah, what an amazing author. I'm trying to get her here. She's a brilliant human too. She's a wonderful human. We talked to her on Ink Heist, and she's one of my favorite guests ever.
I would love to meet her.
Yeah. So we managed to get her on. I'll see if I can finagle a guest host slot.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, you're welcome to guest host anytime. There's a slot available anytime you want to, but. I mean, because I know you're sitting there bored all the time.
Yeah, I have nothing to do.
So what are your pet hates in horror then? When you read, what are the things you really don't like to see? Maybe because they've been done to death, or they just really irritate you in some way.
Okay, so one would be it wasn't last year, it might have been the year before that. There were a ton of books that I read that had the stepdad trope of the alcoholic stepdad who's abusive. And I just couldn't read it anymore. Like, I have a loving stepdad who rescued me and my mom. And he's like one of the best things about my life. And so I just got tired of reading the abusive stepdad trope. Like, please, can we just like have a wonderful stepdad? Like, or just celebrate dads in general. Like, I do feel like dads get a bad rap in horror. And I know a lot of people have daddy issues, so I'm not saying like don't do it anymore, but man, that was a hard one there for a while. I was just like, I would start to read it and it would come up and I'd be like, bleh. You know, just toss it aside. What else? Oh my gosh. I was just talking about this year. In thrillers, I am really, really tired of the unreliable female narrative. Like she's either hormonal or she's crazy or she's tired, and like nothing she says can be viewed in any kind of like reality. So like, you know, we can't trust the narrator who is a woman. Like, let's have an unreliable male narrator. I would really like that.
makes a note. All right, and what are the favorite things then? Because those are the ones you don't like. I know you like coming of age, sort of horrible.
Yes,
what are your, what are your favorites? It. Yeah. What else then, apart from that?
I love coming of age. I love cults. I think that cults are a lot of fun. If I know that there's going to be some freaky cult, I'm totally down with that. I enjoy books that talk about a haunted house that never gets old. And Beverly Lee's The House of Little Bones. I know I keep talking about it, but it's fresh in my brain because I just read it. She has a really unusual twist that I think readers will enjoy. So that's all I'll say about that. I enjoy when female protagonists are kick-ass and, you know, take charge in their story and don't need to be held, but need to be held back because they're large and in charge. I also really like, what did I just read recently that I really liked? I'm really starting to enjoy the crossover between thriller and horror. And I don't know if it's like a marketing thing, but I just think the line is being blurred and it doesn't, horror doesn't necessarily always have to be especially brutal and traumatizing and, you know, really dark or bleak. But it could also, you know, take the shape of like a crime noir or a thriller or a psychological thing. You know, it doesn't always have to be strictly horror. And I love when those lines are blurred. Is it's funny, we've sort of adopted S.A. Cosby into our horror family, and yeah, he writes primarily crime fiction. So there's something there. You know, there's something that we like, our dark brains.
Yeah, it was like when Jordan Harper wrote She Rides Shotgun, all of a sudden he was a member of the horror community, even though that's just straight up noir fiction, you know.
Yeah, and it's funny, it's just like, hey, we like that and give us more of it. So
yeah just make it dark and mean, and we're all gonna jump on it,
you know? yeah give us something unexpected and something that we can you know, lay in bed and torture ourselves with.
Do you have traditional tropes that that you like to see people twist?
Like, yes. Hold on. I'm going to shut my window because somebody just started mowing the lawn. Hang on.
Okay. I'm just making sure that's not here. Not my lawn, not my neighbors.
It's definitely not here, is it, Steph? No, is
it? No, it's not here. It's a bit dark. I usually get it in the morning in the cemetery. They're cutting that grass around those graves every morning for hours on end.
Okay,
we're still in summer here. You guys are actually starting to drift into fall. We're still having summer. Yeah.
In Oregon, Shane?
Yeah, we were 90 day before yesterday and 85 yesterday.
Gross.
Yeah, it's horrible.
It's raining, right? It's raining here now.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, right now.
okay, I'm just...
so you asked a trope that I like when people twist it.
Yeah, you know, like Stephen did with Mongrels.
Oh yeah, well, I love Stephen Graham Jones.
Yeah.
I just interviewed him the other day and I was just like, wow, he's the best. I do like when people take lore, like creature lore, like what Stephen Graham Jones did with Mongrels, where he took, like, you know, traditional werewolf legend and lore, and he kind of like did different things with it. Like, I love the vampire stuff, like with garlic and a stake through the heart and sensitivity to light. But I like it when there's new things introduced to something that's kind of tried and true. Like, I just read Rovers, and the author's name escapes me right now. But he added in like some additional some additional lore to the traditional stuff with that we usually see with vampires. And that's always like really a trip because we're so used to the lore of certain things that we, if once somebody like an author kind of goes outside of it, we're kind of like, I don't know if I can hang with that. I can't hang with, you know, they turn into this or that, or they do this thing or whatever. But I think if we're really true to ourselves, like that's the way that we adapt our storytelling to keep it fresh for our generation. And that's always cool when we can recognize that somebody's evolving the traditions.
Really, even Hollywood, when they started making films about vampires and things, they evolved it. I mean, if you read Dracula and then you watch the first Dracula film, most of the myths, most of the vampire legends came from the film, you know? People have been innovating ever since, you know, time began. That's how story, I think, got created, right?
Right. Definitely.
But go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so what is your rate of reading then? How many books do you get through a year? Well, a day, day, months, years, how many?
Well, like right now I'm around 130 for the year. And I try, like the last 2 years I've hit like a 200. So I push myself to get there. But I have noticed that I'm not tackling like the giant novels anymore. I kind of gravitate towards the novellas and the novelettes. I think the longest things that take me the most time to get through are anthologies and collections. Mm-hmm. An anthology can take so much time. Like, I just read the Shirley Jackson one, and I was making notes for every single story, you know? And then you have to, like, readjust your entire mind frame to get into the next voice, you know? So you're not just getting accustomed to one author and then going along in a linear fashion with this author and getting to know them. You're adjusting every single time that narrative changes. So that's really labor intensive, but I love short stories so much. So I would never change that and move on to, you know, just doing novels. You know, I think novels can wear you down just as much. So I think like in a month, I try to get through at least six, two a week, really. Two or three
does
a week.
Does it ever take away? Do you ever feel as though you're sort of falling out of love with reading a little bit sometimes when you know you've got a lot to read and you start to feel stressed by the fact you've got to read, even though it's something you love to do? Does it start to sort of react against that bit?
So I've never hit the reading slump. I know that people do. It's never happened to me. And I am afraid of it. Like I would be frightened if like I started coming through books and being like, I can't get into this one or this one or this one, like that would start to freak me out. But I do find that there is a level of exhaustion, and it'll come when I notice that I'm binge watching stuff on TV instead of reading. I'll be like, oh, I must be burned out a little bit.
Yeah. And then take it. Do it. If you're burned out, take the time.
Yeah. So we have been watching quite a bit of shows. So I've kind of made that recognition in myself where it's like, oh, you're just giving yourself a break. But honestly, no, I never get really tired of it in the sense that I just don't want to do it anymore, especially not horror. I think it just is ramped up, like where I'm just, people are like, do you ever get sick of reading horror and you want to just get out of that game and review something else? I'm like, no, I would have FOMO so bad if I was looking in and seeing all of my people releasing new horror and I wasn't in on it. Right. I'd buy it just to have it.
Same.
I don't know. I'm not going to read it. I just want it.
I have hundreds of books that I bought for that very reason. I just wanted to have it.
Yeah. I know it's new. I know I'm going to love it. I just don't know when I'm going to read it. So yep. I just want it.
But that's a good question, Steph. It's like, I don't know, Sadie's had a lot of stuff happen in her life over the last 8 years, so she may not remember this, but right after I met her, we had been brought together by an award that didn't ever come to pass. that we were going to be judges on. But, you know, that good thing came out of that situation.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Sadie and I both were doing a Goodreads challenge. The last year I did a Goodreads challenge. We hit these ridiculously high numbers on it, especially Sadie. It's like I hit something like 180 books that year or something, and she broke 200 easy. and I looked at as soon as Goodreads hit it and says, you know, something like you've tripled your goal or something like that. And then basically I was trying to catch her. I failed. But at the end of that year, just seeing those numbers, I was so freaking exhausted. I quit doing Goodreads challenges forever and stopped setting numbers for myself. It's like, it just wasted me.
Yeah, you just have to set the goal really low, like set it at like 50 so that you're always ahead of schedule. That's what I've learned, is it's psychological. It's like this placebo thing. It tells you you're 14 books ahead of schedule and you're like that all year. It's like, I can kick ass on that the whole time. But the minute they tell me I'm 3 books behind, fuck that. I'm changing my goal.
Right? Fuck that, I am.
I'm like, okay, make it 75 then, not 120, and I can hit that.
We all have little tricks like that. I think I have a Goodreads shelf called the 10. And in my head, I tell myself those 10 books on that list are the only books I have to read in my life between now and the rest of my life. And every time I knock one off, I put another one at the end. So.
Hey, that's cool. I like that.
Keeps me from stressing myself out.
I think I'm at 70. Yeah, my target's 70 and I'm about 2 off with that. But I couldn't put it any higher because of the writing. I just get stressed looking at it. But like you, I like to be ahead. And when I was working as a librarian, I used to pick up the young adult books. I loved young adult horror and all sorts of books for the young adults then. And they're quick reads. So when I was working that way, it used to bump my level up as well.
Yeah, Stephanie, that's actually really interesting, too, about how you say about the reading and the writing. Like, one gets in the way of the other. That's what I've learned. So that's another reason why I wasn't enjoying writing as much as I was, you know, because I the reading is so important to me, and it was definitely getting in the way of it. So I can see how the reading would get in the way of the writing.
Not if you're Stephanie. She's just like, if you send her a book right now, 600 pages long, she'll tell you how much she liked it 10 minutes later.
If I know I've got to read it for a purpose, then I will sort of put time aside, because I do like, it's an excuse to read for me, because I do love, reading is like a physical need, and the same with writing. And sometimes I just have to stop writing to read, and the reading, because it's part of writing, it's a good excuse to just go and lose myself in a book for a while. So I've just finished Chuck Wendig's House of Accidents. No, book. Is it Book of Accidents? House of Accidents. I can't remember now.
Yeah, the Book of Accidents.
That's it. Yeah. It's like a place in a house.
Yeah, I love that book.
Yeah, I like his books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the cool thing about Chuck Wendig, too. His particular writing, he didn't do it so much in the Book of Accidents, but he does in the Miriam Black series and Wanderers, but he has these like short, buzzy chapters that just keep you consuming. Like, you're going to be like, okay, well, I'm going to read this last little chapter. And then the next one, you can see that it ends in a page. So once you get to that end of the page, you just keep going. Like, it ruined me for all long chapters. I cannot, like, if a chapter is super long, it's like, I just want like a place where I can stop, you know, like, give me a place where I can stop, because I won't. I'll keep going after that.
That's one of those things, like Danger Slater, the Bizarro author, does that. His chapters, I'm not a big Bizarro fan, but his books, I get into some of them a lot, and that's what happens. They're all really short chapters. So you're like, okay, I'm going to quit for the night. And you turn the page and start to put the book. Oh, that's only a paragraph. Okay.
I can do that.
Yeah, exactly. Next thing you know, you're 3/4 of the way through the book and crickets are chirping outside and sun's coming up, you know.
Yep.
But
or your Kindle, the Kindle gives you the percentage at the bottom too. Yeah. It'll be like, you have 2 minutes left in this chapter. You're like, oh, I can do that.
Yeah. we all make excuses for why we're psycho, but in the long run, it's just mutual nerdism.
Yes.
But I mean, it's really, this is why this right here, you know, the conversations we can have, the people we meet, the friends we make. I've met and made the best friends of my life in this business. And I didn't even intend for any of this to be happening. You know, when I started, I had no ambitions to do anything but read books. And then I saw people were talking about them and thought, that's a cool thing to do. Tell people about the authors you love. So I started doing that and boom, you know, and then you're like, it's been a frenzy of activity with you ever since I met you. It's like, it just seems like you've got so many irons in the fire, and it was like, you know, the announcements sometimes exhaust me. It's like, my God, how are you still going? I'm sitting here tired listening to you. You know?
Try being me, Shane.
Yeah.
Have you got anything big coming up that you can actually tell us about, or is it all hush hush?
The Nightworm stuff is always hush hush, just because we never know if things are gonna like pan out. But we do have some exciting things coming up. In October, I'm really excited. I am doing 3 kind of major events for me that I'm really excited about. A bookstore is hosting an event with Josh Mallerman, and his team of people reached out and asked if I would co-host with him this event celebrating Pearl, which is his book coming out really soon. So I'm going to do that in October with Josh. And then I also have another panel that I'm doing for a bookstore with now I have to remember the 3 authors, but I think it's Cassandra Kaw and Rachel Harrison and, oh, I cannot remember the Tanya. Ooh, I don't remember. She wrote The Reckoning or the, It'll come to me. Mm. So I'm excited about that as well. I'm kind of moderating that. And then Flame Tree reached out to do something with Jonathan Jantz, a conversation about horror over 2021 with Jonathan Jantz at the end of the month, I think like October 30th. So it's like a little Halloween thing. So I bought like a costume to wear. So I found my top hat. Here, I'll just show you. I found a top hat.
Oh, very nice. It's going to be
part of my costume. So... yeah, some exciting things coming in October. Oh, and then there's one special thing I cannot talk about at all, but I will say I got to write a foreword/introduction for an anthology that's coming that I think will be announced really soon. I can't say what it's for. So I'm really excited about it.
And my little slice of that excitement is Sadie, and Sadie is going to be on the Ink Heist Live Halloween show as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Sadie and the ladies of the Fright, Lisa Quigley and Mackenzie Kiera.
That will be a fun episode.
It will. It's going to be a blast.
Yeah.
Loads of fun. Liquor optional.
Necessary.
Yeah. So, I'm excited about that anthology. I can't wait to see what that ends up being. I have a sneaking suspicion, but I won't babble. So,
I can't wait till it's announced.
It's always hard too when you're talking to someone, like, because you know how authors will tell you things sometimes and say,
"Oh wow, that cut out right at the best moment."
It's
like deliberate.
We have to fill in the missing gap.
What an author will say, dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
take a picture and we'll put it up on Twitter and ask for the caption.
Right before the finale.
But the trouble is, you shouldn't really guess, because if you guess right, and then you'd have to look as though it wasn't the right thing, and then it could all come out, and then it wouldn't be a surprise for anybody. So it's best to guess anything.
I would get in so much trouble.
Okay, I've got a question now, because you were talking about all the things that are coming up. You are becoming a much more visible physical presence now, doing a lot of presenting and talking and reading things online. I remember a few years back, well, I don't know how long ago, but you started doing the little talks on Twitter, the little reads, and saying you were nervous then, but you've come out, you do more and more. Is that a way you want to go? Can you see yourself maybe appearing on TV and presenting shows about horror or something like that? Or...
Yeah, it's funny, because for about 5 years, well, it could be almost six, so all 4 years of high school I was in drama and theater, so I am really used to being like on stage in front of people, and that doesn't bother me at all. Like, I don't get nervous about that at all. I can get up in front of, I mean, I have been in front of like a pretty large audience, and I've been in front of like a really intimate audience, which is actually more intimidating than a large one. I did like black box theater, where the actors are right in front of your audience and they're just kind of sitting right among you. And I do really enjoy that. I love performing. I just find that I don't like when I can see my face. Like, that's the part that's the hardest for me. Like, doing the videos and the StreamYards and the live YouTubes and stuff, I hate seeing my own face. I don't want to look at it while I'm trying to do something. So I did have to kind of talk myself up to do like the TikToks and the readings and such. If I could find a way to do that without looking at myself, it would be a lot easier. But yeah, I would love to move forward in doing more visible components and going to cons. And just really meeting people in real life, because I do feel like a large part of what's missing in our horror community is knowing people for real life, knowing them, and just knowing that there's real people with real feelings and real lives and families that love them. I think when we're busy, not necessarily demonizing people, because that seems really extreme, but just kind of formulating our idea of who a person is based on their online persona is so antithetical to who those people actually are. Like, I am not what I tweet. I am not who I appear to be in podcast interviews and stuff, as like you get a little bit of a more of a glimpse, but I have kids that I goof around with in my living room, and a husband who we watch shows together and we cry together and we have really meaningful conversations, and there's shit going on in my life, and there's phone calls that I'm getting that are like awful, and then there's stuff that's happening in my life that's exciting, and you know, I want to celebrate those things, but that stuff doesn't make it to social media. I'm not talking about every aspect or every facet of my life. But I am a person, you know, and I am like, I want to share those things with people, like in real life, in real context, and have conversations where we're having eye contact and we can drink a beer and we can laugh with each other and like see each other's faces and our tone and expression. And I'm really looking forward to having those connections with people that I've chatted with online for 5+ years, you know?
Yeah. That was like, yeah, we chatted for what, 5+ years. And I think I talked to you person to person, except for the podcast that time, just this year.
Yeah.
You know, and we're like 2.5 hours away from each other.
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, they're like, Jeremy Robert Johnson and I like talk quite a bit, and he lives in Portland too, and it's like, yeah. I can't wait to like actually meet people. Like Paul Tremblay, we were so upset, we were supposed to meet each other at Merrimack, and he's been a great friend for so long. I just want to see his dumb face like in real life.
Yeah. And there's so many of them. I just like, it would be so awesome to get every one of us, you know, all into the same place at the same time and just have one massive world con, you know.
Yeah, we need something after the friggin' hell we've all been through.
Jeez. Right. One thing about the last year, though, I think is that it's taught us a lot about ourselves. It's taught us a lot about each other. It's caused drastic changes in the community, but most of them, I think, have been for the better. There are still all the drama and whatnot, controversy, but at least for me personally, my own personal relationships are a little bit more solidified, you know what I mean? And I learned to use social media as far as timeline feeds go and things like that more as a connection tool and a marketing tool and not so much as a part of my personality because, like you say, that's just not the place for that. That's not the place, you know, where we learn things like that. Your husband saying bingo bango bothers you.
His greatest joy in his life is annoying me. That he like gets so much personal joy and happiness if I'm like severely annoyed.
My favorite pastime is making my wife laugh till she pees, but.
Yeah, that's his other thing. They work in tandem.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I should start winding this up and let you get on with your day. We're sitting in the middle of our day here on what is a gorgeous day in Portland, but I'd rather it was raining.
It is raining for me, and we're just 2 hours away, which is so weird.
I know.
Well, it's very dark here. Is it very dark in your graveyard, Steph?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's very quiet out there. They're sleeping well tonight. But the beach behind me is where I was today. So that was earlier.
That's where you are mentally, Stephanie.
Yeah.
I'm reading a lovely book by that lady, by the way. I'm not going to say anything else about that, but yeah, Steph.
By right. Stephanie?
Yes. I'm reading a novella that'll knock your socks off, and that's all I'm going to say. I'll talk to you about that in the morning when you get up. But, yeah.
It's my first for Silver Shamrock for that contract I've got with them. I owe them 3 novels and 3 novellas. So I sent them all my novels that I'd got already done, and I've got to do the novellas now, so that's the first one. And hopefully they'll like that one.
Stephanie, do you think that writing novellas is easier or harder than a full-length novel?
I tell myself it's easier because the pace should be quicker. But then when I do that, I give myself too much time and I faff around. At the minute, I'm writing the second one and I'm finding it harder than a novel because I'm having to keep out things that I would want to expand on. You know, it's quite hard to get it right. But I think in terms of turning them round, a novella is quicker. But in theory, I actually prefer the novella because then I can go into something a bit more. But novellas are quite a new field for me. I've only done a few, It's something I want to do just to get more work out there. This is what I want to do with my life is to write.
Yeah.
And the more I can get out there, the better. Novellas, like you say, reading novellas to get your reading challenge up or whatever. The writing, I'd like to do a lot more novellas. I've got 2 more ideas already, but I can see them turning into novels if I'm not careful. It's just how to stop. That's the thing.
That's a good question, though. What about you, Beverly?
I found writing The House of Little Bones, which was my first novella, really difficult because originally it was going to be a novel, but I got to about 57K and the story just wasn't working and there was just something not quite right about it. And I had to peel it back and I realised then that I'd lost the heart of it. So then that's when I realized that maybe it would work better as a novella, which it did. But the thing about a novella is that you've got to get that character development in such a short amount of words. And there's quite a few times in Little Bones where I probably would have gone off on a tangent, but I had to rein it in because I was aiming for a certain, a certain word count.
And I don't know if it's psychological. It's not really psychological. It's like when I've mentioned this here before, when I wrote that contest piece for Cemetery Gates, the flash piece, I thought, oh, I'm looking at 900, 1,000 words. This is going to be cake. And I'm writing a story about cake now, too. it was the hardest thing I've ever written in my life, that 900 words. It was 900 words, and it was extremely painful.
I think it's so worth it, though, because on the reader side of things, man, those things come out tight, like,
yeah.
And it is just like when I can finish something from beginning to end, that is like such a feeling of satisfaction. Like, I feel like I get the whole scope of what the writer was saying and what the writer was doing because I finished that piece in my brain from point A to the end. And then when you're reading a novel and you keep sticking that bookmark in and you walk away and you're doing something else, or I'll pick up another novel here and there, or I read something in between it and come back to it, I'm always finding like I'm just like I lose something there and have to pick it up again. Mm. But the novella or the short story is just like, bam, right there. It's just like, I love that.
I do too, especially as a reader. And as a writer, it's just a masochistic challenge that I have to endure for my own peace of mind, you know?
Yeah.
But it's really, I feel like it makes me a better poet, especially flash fiction, because every single word has to mean something. It has to matter, you know? And it's so hard to make that happen. But, anyway, see, this is what we do. We say goodbye and then we talk for 30 minutes.
That's what we do over here.
I think we did this last week too.
We did.
But yeah, so we're going to have Josh Mallerman is our next airing episode. We just talked to him last week. And then Sadie Hartman will be the one the week after that one. I'll let you know the exact date when I know. And you are officially on what I'm calling the unnameable right now, because we are in the process of rebranding and changing our name. WordPress.com, when I deserted them and moved my domain name, they failed to push the auth code through, so I lost my domain last week.
Oh, shoot.
Or actually, I lost it last month. I just realized it last week because I got back on my ADHD meds and had the wherewithal to look. But like I told Beverly last night, I think once you figure out that you can't do anything about a thing, then it's just water under the bridge. Move on, you know. So we're taking this as our opportunity, you know, to make this 100% not, you know, something that Shane had been doing something else with, but something that the three of us are doing. So you will be on the
unnameable
podcast.
If you've got any ideas, yeah. If you've got any ideas, let us know.
By all means, yeah.
Yeah. I am like horrible with like titles and names and things like that. So, but if I do think of something, I'll let you know.
Yeah, lob it our way and we'll stick it into the list I have going.
You know what I think that some bands and podcasts actually do, and maybe this would be a good fun exercise for you guys just to try it. Each one of you should come up with like a dozen favorite words, okay, that kind of have like something to do with what you're thinking. And then literally draw three out and just see if they go together. Like, think about your favorite band. Like, remember like in the 90s there was Toad the Wet Sprocket? Drew those names out of a hat. Sometimes like, I like Toad, and someone's like, How about Sprocket?
A box of frogs. I remember
you
that.
Could say favorite band, favorite vegetable, and favorite color or something.
Yeah, something like that, and then pull them out of a hat and be like, oh, cool, we are, horticulturist, blah, blah, blah. You know, it would be something so random, but, like, yeah. It would work.
I do like that idea.
I do, too. The Judas Gardening Crew or something.
Seriously, it would work.
Actually, that's a good idea, though, to start, just take the words single. It's easier for you to, for especially me, to you say six favorite words, and my head all goes, oh, well, here's 40.
Yeah. See, there are words that you enjoy using that, you know, like I told Christopher Triana the other day, I said, guess what? You have a favorite word. He goes, oh, I do? What? And I said, the word sluice. Sluice or sluicing shows up in every freaking story you write. Blood sluicing through his fingers, spit sluicing through his teeth. Like, he uses it in every story. So that would be one of his words, sluice.
Yeah. Stephen Graham Jones is a UC person. He said, we just talked to him. He said that he has his editors always have to tell him how many to remove. Because his characters, you know, when he has a character talking, they'll finish something they're saying, or a narrator will finish a sentence with you see or you see or something like that. Yeah. And he does it a lot. So he says the first thing I do after I turn a novel in is sit there and wait for the editor to come back and tell me how many of those to take out.
Once you see those words in a writer's work, you'll see them everywhere.
Yeah.
It amazed me when I started working with an actual editor who critiqued my work, you know, Steve Petty over at Horror DNA. I had never really realized all the freaking redundancy, and I hate redundancy. It's like the word Kenneth, 700 times.
Yep.
I got a list from Kenneth Kane when he did my he's done the novellas and the novels. I've got a whole list of words now that he lectures me about. The trouble is that the novels I've sent to him are ones that I wrote before those, so those words are still going to be in there. And he's going to be saying, I told you to take those out, because he can be brutal.
Isn't there like a tool or something you can drop down and look for words and it'll find all those words?
Yeah, I've got those. It's just the whole list of the actual words that I overuse.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah, it's especially obvious when somebody uses them back to back in a sentence. I like usually will highlight that portion if I'm beta reading. And even if it's just the word have had or, you know, just something and it's used back to back, it's like a neon sign. You see it like so glowing.
I do it intentionally sometimes. Sometimes there is use for repeating yourself, mostly as far as cadence goes, but that's more of a poetic thing than, you know, an emphatic thing, you know, to apply emphasis to what you're saying or what a character is saying in their dialogue. But Beverly has a favorite word too, but I won't tell anybody.
Oh, that word.
Oh, that word.
No, if I'm doing it is that word. It's the word that. I'm terrible. My first drafts are like littered with the word that, and then I'm going to go through and pull them all out because it's such a redundant word in a lot of cases. You don't need it in a sentence, but it's how my brain writes. I'm writing quickly, but yeah, I think in the first draft of Gabriel, when I went through, I had 1,700 cases of the word that.
It reduces your word count, though, doesn't it? You get up to a certain level, and then you cut out all those words, and it drops down again, and you think you've got to hit a certain level to submit to your editor. And so you're back there trying to add in more story because you just lost a load of words. It's horrible.
Aww.
Oh, the joys.
It will come as a big surprise to everybody that I have to, after every time I finish anything I write, I have to search for the word that and I have to search for the F word. I don't know why.
G-Y, Shane.
And Amazon. But I think that's it for me. I'm going to get out of here and go do some work and let you three get on with your days and nights. And hope you have an awesome one.
Yeah, I'm good to go too.
Yes.
Get on with the swing there.
Yeah.
it was wonderful to finally speak to you, Sadie. It's only taken 6 years.
Yeah, right? Oh my gosh, it's so good to see your face, all your faces, and hang out with you.
We're all human.
Yeah, even you, Shane.
Yeah, I said, and there's no peanut butter behind me.
Not this time.
Yeah.
All right, then.
Okay. Yeah, I can cut off the awkward ending, too. Thanks a lot, Sadie. Love you.
Thank you, Sadie.
Bye,
Sadie. Thank you.
Bye.
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 Bye.